Okay, we're going to talk about science, education, you name it, artificial intelligence, Mars, and your phone calls with Sir Charles Schulz III when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. We're going to get your call, Sir Charles Schulz. Sir Charles, by the way, I want to thank you for the years of dedicated service to this program. I mean, you just keep working for us, and you give us great information. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate coming on the show. It's a lot of fun to hear how people respond and just to spread a little hope and a little information. That's great for me.
What do you see as some of the most exciting things out there for us? Is it going to Mars? Is it artificial intelligence? What might it be?
I think that it's hard to separate them because the future is going to be all of those things mixed together. But two things that stick out in my mind right now, the quantum teleportation, you know, we're going to have applications for that immediately in communication. Imagine two boxes like two cell phones, and you send information back and forth without any radio waves between them or anything that can be blocked. That's right around the corner. The other one is this impossible space drive they've been working on, a device you turn on that creates a thrust without using any fuel. If the tests bear out on that, that could be one of the most revolutionary things we have.
You think we might get artificial gravity devices and machines?
Well, it's a certain possibility. I think that what's going to really happen is we're going to find, if this space drive idea works, we may find out a way of producing non-directional thrust or unidirectional thrust, and that would be the same thing for all practical purposes. I mean, you could still make things that would levitate without using any fuel or noise.
That would be amazing. Oh, my gosh. That would be truly amazing.
We're just about there.
Let's go to Hawthorne, New Jersey. Thomas is with us on Coast to Coast. Thomas, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
I'm offering up some comments, some observations on what your guest has said and how we have lost the sense of genius in America. He's absolutely how we have become dumbed down progressively. And I've offered a few examples here. In 1907, there was a professor of sociology at Yale observed the quality of the immigration that was coming into America, and he summed it up in these words, Europe is vomiting. The genius that we had in Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, James Madison, Washington, people of their time, it's gone, either gone or in hiding. Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1780 in the only book that he published, Notes from the State of Virginia, that if we brought immigration into America, it would destroy the culture and the Constitution. And this is exactly what has happened.
I don't agree with that. I think legal immigration has allowed this country to prosper and to get to where it's going. From even Project Paperclip, when we brought the German scientists in, I think, Charles, legal immigration has been just incredible for this country, don't you?
Well, it has. I mean, the fact is, at the root, all of our ancestors were immigrants here. And when you stop and think about it, it's not immigration that's the issue, it's education. Anybody has the ability to become educated, and intelligence and education often go hand in hand. But I think one of the problems we face today is a very simple one. People confuse education with intelligence. And they're absolutely radically different.
Well, there's no question about that. No question. Let's go to John in Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to the show. John, go ahead.
Hi, this is John, Tucson.
Hi, John, good to have you with us. Go ahead.
You were talking about why there aren't any Einsteins. One of the reasons is the scientific community doesn't want an Einstein. They don't want a big jump forward because it would mess up their grants. And it's hard for someone like me to get published because I don't have a university address.
What do you do, John?
What do I do? I have a theory. A theory that takes the universe from its beginning to now. Parts of it are pretty speculative, but it's different than anything that's currently accepted.
Give us the Cliff Notes version.
Okay. Gravitation is declining and has been doing that since the beginning. As a result of that, the universe is expanding. Dark matter is unnecessary. Dark energy comes from the following process. Gravitation declines. Pressure declines throughout the universe. When the pressure declines, atoms that have been pressure ionized by the huge pressure of the past periodically can gain an electron. When they do that, the ion expands.
Now, when you say you're not published or you're not allowed to publish, why? Who's holding you back?
I don't know. I've tried to publish this a couple times and been rejected.
Well, Charles, what does he do?
You know, it's sometimes very difficult to break into the field. And I think in part it's because a lot of times people who do research at what's considered the fringe have a very tough time getting anyone to listen. What's taught in universities, what's taught in the books, has a long history behind it. And so there's a very good reason for a lot of it being accepted, observations and experiments. So when you come along with something radical, you have to have something in it so easy to test, so logically clear and consistent, that somebody reads it and goes, oh, wait a minute, that seems to make sense. I think that the big thing is, if you're trying to publish something of this sort, you've got to have a hook in it that is so clear, so consistent, and so reasonable that anybody who reads it, who understands physics, will go, aha.
Aha, the old aha factor. John is in Norton, Massachusetts. John, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead.
Given the vastness of just our galaxy alone, I know it's been suggested by some physicists that the only way any visitation could occur is if it's artificial. So some sort of vehicles that could replicate themselves, and maybe they've given some information back to whatever universe. But isn't it just so vast that the odds are we've never been visited?
Well, actually, no. Recent estimates show that in our galaxy alone, and estimates say there are between 200 and 400 billion stars just in our galaxy, they're already looking at an estimate of approximately 40 billion Earth-like planets in our galaxy. So we know that there's got to be life out there. So the machines you're talking about are called von Neumann machines. They're self-replicating machines. Now, a technically advanced race could, in theory, produce a spacecraft that reaches another solar system, makes copies of itself, and then spreads out to even more solar systems. And even traveling slower than the speed of light, in less than 1 million to 10 million years, such a system would have spread across the entire galaxy. So people ask, where are these machines? And it's possible that some of them are in our own asteroid belt, silently sitting right now, thousands or millions of years old. That's one of the unresolved questions and one of the things we'd like to know. It's a possibility. We don't have the answer to that one yet. But I'll tell you, the odds are very, very high that there are intelligent neighbors out there. And some of them may have technologies that allow them to get here much faster than something traveling slower than light. We just don't know the answers to that one yet, but it's certainly possible.
There's no question about it. You jumpstart civilizations 1 million years ahead of us, 1 billion years ahead of us, assuming they didn't wipe themselves out. Who knows how far advanced they could be at this point, Charles?
That's true. Well, and look at what we're doing right now. We're approaching something that they call the singularity from all intents and purposes. We're going to reach a point where we can't even keep track of the growth of information. Personally, I think that if we see the changes in quantum mechanics and in physics that we're experiencing right now, like the teleportation and like the reactionless drive, it may be possible to send material somewhere else at the speed of light or even faster than the speed of light. I know that the spooky action at a distance reaction that Einstein commented on many years ago is something that they've actually measured and is real. It may be possible to, in a sense, teleport things or use quantum mechanics or entanglement to get material from one end of the solar system to another or even to another star system, which is funny because I wrote a book called Annihilus, a science fiction novel, that used that same principle. And within a few years, they confirmed that they could create quantum entanglement in diamonds, very similar to what I wrote about in the story. So you never know. It could happen.
Will we ever get computers like HAL and Space Odyssey who literally do their own thing?
There's no doubt that we will. We already have systems that aren't intelligent but act a lot like it, like the Siri and the cell phones and other things. It doesn't take a lot of imagination to see that if they discover the spark of intelligence itself and get it in the hardware, it's going to be very similar to HAL in many ways.
Michael is with us, first-time caller. Go ahead, Michael. Good to have you with us.
Hey, George, it's me, Michael. I've been listening to you since I was like 12 years old.
Well, thank you, Michael. Appreciate it.
I heard, Sir Charles, you said that the nation's turning us down, and I couldn't help but think about the Teen Choice Award in the United States and how do we solve that issue right then? How do we solve it? Yeah, I want to know your opinion.
You know, I think that really we have to start at the very fundamentals. We've got to educate people, and it takes 5 to 10 years for that process to spread like a ripple from the bottom to the top. People work so much to influence people who are already adults. It's too late by then in a lot of ways. You have to start with people when they're very young. You have to educate them, teach them, and get them involved. And I don't just mean in doing things or finding jobs, but in becoming a part of the fabric of their community. We have the answers to everything, but we have to work together to implement them. The foundation is important, the education.
You believe that government and industry is kind of putting a thumb on us. They don't want us truly informed. How come?
Well, and that seems to be the case. I mean, we see cases, like I mentioned previously, where they're standing in front of us using alternative power systems. And we've reached a stage where people don't make waves anymore. They're becoming socially very much like sheep. It's very easy for a company to squash information. I mean, look at the fracking thing. I think that somebody had mentioned to me a few months ago, if somebody came from another country and said, we're going to put explosives in your water table and blow it up so you can't get any water, that would be considered an act of terrorism. Why is it that a company can say, well, we're going to do that, and not only that, if you see the chemicals that we use and you tell someone who it is, you know, who's putting it there and what they are, we're going to sue you and put you in jail. They're dumbing you down. They're trying to control the flow of information because it means they can act with impunity. There's very clear evidence that it's being done.
And also, don't tell anybody because we're causing earthquakes every time we do this.
Oh, that's what they're doing. There's a rash of earthquakes these days, yes.
Oklahoma just had one again, and I think they're doing a lot of fracking there.
Well, if you take a bunch of stuff out from under the ground that's holding up the surface,
that's
and then you start blowing up the ground, let's just think this through from a common sense standpoint. Something's going to fall.
As big as this planet is, Charles, you're right. You can't keep taking things out of there. And I think that's the same with oil, too. You know, I'm an abiotic oil theorist, but the more you take out, you're doing something to the planet, aren't you?
Well, there's no question about it. There's absolutely no question. When you remove oil from underground, when you remove gas from underground, the ground settles. That's a no-brainer. Everybody knows the answer to that one. So when we see people suddenly surprised, wow, the ground broke through and a lake went in it, and yeah, this happens all the time. Most of the drilling that happens for oil sites these days is now near the margins. It's offshore where you don't see it happen because the ocean fills it in, or it's either there or it's up in the highlands where an ocean can't rush in and fill it, but the ground level does shift. So people have been measuring and keeping track of that for years. It's a known fact. The ground sinks after you take stuff out.
Let's go to Ray in Wickenburg, Arizona. Hey, Ray, thank you. Go ahead.
Hey, you know, you were mentioning that there aren't many Einsteins or brilliant minds coming up in the ranks, and I wanted to mention to you, you need to get this guy on your radio show. I can't tell you his name because this was about 3 weeks ago on a popular morning news broadcast. They had a segment about a 28-year-old, I believe his title is a physicist, and it took 10 years to develop a machine in his mom and dad's garage that has successfully captures pollutants and carbon molecules out of the atmosphere and transfers them into solids to produce plastics and has successfully manufactured Ziploc plastic storage bags and plastic furniture and some other plastic type products, replacing the petroleum product. And you talk about a threat to the petroleum industry, and they had this kid on the segment on that morning. It was, well, maybe it was only about 3 minute long segment. And I thought to myself, okay, let's see if we ever see anything more about that ever again, because so many times in my lifetime I've seen these inventions come across the news wire, and then you never hear anything about it again.
Well, like, what happens, Ray, with those things is they generally get bought out by big corporations who just sit on it. They do this, Charles, all the time, don't they?
Well, they certainly do, but there's something interesting to think about in this. Such a process is going to have a hard time competing with oil because it takes an awful lot of air to make just a little bit of plastic. Now, if you look at plant growth, everybody who's grown a plant knows that the plant only consumes a fraction of a percent of its material from the soil, but all the rest comes from the carbon dioxide in the air and the rain that falls on it. So growing things out of the air or making things out of the air is an extremely viable process. All plant life on Earth depends on it. That's how they're there. But when you look at producing things like fuels or plastics, it can be expensive because the amount of energy it takes for the process to work is your limiting factor. If these machines are built and they're powered by wind or sun or something that doesn't take power from the grid, then yes, you can be ahead of the game. So these technologies are very useful, but they often are limited in where they can be applied properly.
With your bot game, once that comes out in September, what are you hoping to accomplish?
What I'm hoping to do is reach a whole market where young people have the opportunity to play games and learn at the same time. And it's one part of our larger Oniros project that I've been working on for a while, bringing education and gaming together. Children, even young people, even older people, I love that video games. And they're very popular throughout society. I want to tap into that, get people playing things that teach them something and have fun at the same time.
Charles has also written several books, The Living Galaxy, A Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It's schultzlaboratories.com. You do keep busy, Sir Charles.
I stay busy all the time, and we just brought another website online, evolveabot.com. It's just as it's spelled. What we're trying to do is get information out there, teach people, and get products out there that they can use, like the windmill that I invented. That's another product that could do an awful lot of good.
It sure can.
Yeah, stay busy.
We're going to come back and take final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And if you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. On our next Coast to Coast program, I'll be talking with an author researcher who has written about some of the most high-profile crimes and criminals of the past decade. So make sure you're part of that program. Should be fascinating. We'll be back in a moment with Sir Charles Schultz and your final calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, final segment with Sir Charles Schultz III, and we'll take your calls as well. Sir Charles, tell us about the knighting. How did that happen? Must have been exciting for you.
It was indeed, and it was the result of some research that I did in nuclear fusion many years ago. And so it was a process carried out by a fellow by the name Dr. Nelson Ying, who was the Baron of Valquine. He was a landed Scottish baron. And the knighting included a five-year research grant for my work and the funding for it. And it meant that the only restrictions were I couldn't work on weapons or defense stuff. So, you know, obviously I want to work on things that make people happy. In my view, the world should be a happy and wonderful place.
People who work on weapons, you know, high technology weapons, do they want to do it, or are they kind of forced to?
You know, I started out in the work because I was very interested in aerospace, and I knew that defending the country was a big, important thing to do, and it was a possibility of doing something really significant and learning about the technology and having exposure in aerospace while at the same time. I did it freely, but over the years I realized just where those weapons were going and what people were doing, and that I began to question the viability of it, the morality of it. And I think a lot of people go into it thinking, I'm going to do something great for the country and discover what it's really all about in the end. And then they pull out, or they have to make peace with themselves internally.
I was going to say, do you have free will? Can you pull out, or is it like the mob? Once you're in, you don't get out.
Yes, you have free will. It's the golden chain more than anything, and you have to decide whether your income is more important than your moral good standing.
All right, let's go to the phones. Final calls here for Sir Charles. We'll go to Ray in St. Louis to get things started. Happens to be a first-time caller. Go ahead, Raymond.
Oh, welcome back home, George.
Good. You are very welcome. Well, but what a lot of things going on here, huh?
Yeah, did you bring your gas mask?
You know what? I'm going out there tomorrow, by the way. So I'll have some information on the show. I will. Thank you.
Okay. Anyway, Sir Charles, earlier in the show, they were talking about sea urchins and monkeys making groups to ward off other groups. And my question to you is, do you think sometime in the future, machines with the artificial intelligence would form groups maybe to pit against us, like maybe Forbin Project or Terminator, you know?
Well, it's very possible. Again, we have to know what we program the machines to do, whether they have free will or not. We do know that in societies of things that don't think, there can be emergent groups for defense. It's just a part of how things work. Society structures, defense structures, all evolve just like anything. And so you're going to see the formations of groups. It doesn't even need intelligence for that to happen.
No, it doesn't. But when it starts, look out.
Look at political parties.
Really? Will robots be able to replicate themselves?
Yes, they will. You know, you look at the 3D printers, they're getting better and better. If you get to the point where a 3D printer can make a motor or a sensor or a microchip, you have the information and the hardware necessary to make self-replicating machines, artificial life. That is the von Neumann machine concept.
Let's go to Penny, east of the Rockies in Parsons, Kansas. Good morning, Penny. Go ahead.
I want to talk to you about Mars.
Mars it is.
How far back does anybody know that a flying saucer or aliens were ever known to be in, somebody sighted them? I was born in 1933. And in 1920, there was supposed to have been a flying saucer. And let me finish. And when I was born of a regular mother, but they said that my father was supposed to have been one of those aliens that came down and impregnated her. But I had red hair, and it was not carrot top. It was some kind of a shiny, glassy hair, kind of like a bright new penny. That's where I got this name. Anyway, when I was 4 years old, I had never been able to go outside of the orphanage and set my feet on the ground till I was 14 because the town people would kill me.
Huh.
The superstition was that any red-headed baby was a product of that flying saucer. And if you had a baby with red hair, you'd kill it. And the blood type of people with the red hair like I have is the same. Well, we could go back and ask Darwin, why is my blood type the same as the apes, and why is my hair red like the apes? But I was told that I came from Mars, and everyone there had red hair. I don't know that to be a fact, but I was told this.
And
the time I was 4 years old, I started asking questions.
So during your entire livelihood, up until now, you believe that you're from another planet?
Partly, yes, sir. Now let me explain.
All right.
My husband was 5 years older than me, and he was in the orphanage. He got out, and he joined the Air Force. His first tour of duty was Occupational Forces of Japan right after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
We got married in 1948. He came back and got me when I was 14 and took me away.
14.
When he was in, they transferred him to the OSSI, which later became the CIA. When he went to that school up in Maryland and took what he needed to know to be in the OSSI, he said, come back. He said, maybe they are flying saucers. We are studying them. Now, this is 1941 and 40, down to 1948.
Right after Roswell.
The Air Force at that time, they were studying in this, I called it a spy school. But anyway, they were studying what was known about flying saucers at that time.
So what do you think of this, Charles?
Well, I think, Penny, that you might have a lot of research. You could put together a very interesting story of your life, and you should be able to find lots of connections, lots of people who know your past. Do some research online. Put it all together in one place. Get it all together into one coherent story. It might be interesting. Who knows? You might get a movie deal.
You never know. That's a pretty fascinating story, huh? Penny, thanks for your call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Gabriel next in Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome to the program, Gabriel. Go ahead.
Hey, George, and hi, Sir Charles Schultz. I was just calling to inform you guys of the new law that was passed in Arizona on solar panels. So there's a lot of leasing companies out here, you know, that lease solar panels to private homeowners. And that, solar panels are very expensive. You know, it costs $20,000, you know, to put them on your roof. But that these leasing companies did another offer, you know, where they put them on your, and you pay them off over time. You know, they put them on your roof, and the Arizona legislature just passed through a law where it puts taxes on every single one of the solar panels that are put on your roof. You know, and it's kind of deterring people from wanting to, you know, lease from these companies and put on solar panels.
Well, you know what comes to mind? You know what comes to mind? It's very simple. If a government tells you to do one thing and then they turn around and penalize you for doing it, we need green energy, but by the way, we're going to charge you for it. Follow the money.
Yeah, it's all about the money, Charles. Always has been, hasn't it?
It absolutely is. And you know, you can tell right away if you just look at the basic assumptions. And you know, our whole life, our science, everything seems to be founded on a lot of assumptions and follow the money. You're going to find the cause very quickly. If they really wanted us to be on alternative energy, they would be subsidizing this, not penalizing us. They would encourage you to remove yourself from the grid. That's as simple. It's that simple. If they were really worried about greenhouse warming, global gas emissions, they'd be planting something, and I don't see that happening. It means it's all about the money.
What is fueling, or who is fueling, the incredible rapid growth of this kind of technology? I mean,
you know what?
Where's the brain power coming from?
It's diffuse. It's individuals, young people. They have access to an awful lot of information, and they're not stupid. What's interesting is this. When they become disconnected from the teaching system, when they become hooked to the internet, not only do they think differently, but they also create differently. And a lot of this creativity is happening because of young people in garages and on the dining room table. They're figuring things out, and they're making things, new things that nobody ever thought of before, because they don't have the same restrictions that traditional education imposes. No matter what happens, we're going to emerge from this better. And it'll be because young people are doing it.
All right. We go next to Chris in Bellbrook, Ohio. Chris, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I know one reason why a lot of people aren't inventing things in our country today is because I know from personal facts, because my grandfather invented, believe it or not, power disc brakes. I actually have the patent that he did. And I remember the car he actually tested it on with a pole coming out of it. Copper tube come out with a gauge on it and everything. He took it to a big company, Ford Motor Company, and you know what they did? They sat on it, waited for it to run out, the patent to run out, and then they tweaked it a little bit, and then they finally put it on their cars, allowing a lot of people to die in the interim, and he never got a penny, and nobody even knows he's even designed it. I've even got the patent. I've got the article in the Cincinnati Inquirer where they talk about him developing it, but it's not known because they waited for the patent to run out. And then he gets no credit, no money, nothing for all that time.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think it's sad.
It's astounding because when a company has that sort of economic resource behind them, the lawyers and the money, they often get away with things, and it is not just. I don't know how that can ever be rectified, and I don't know if we'll ever eliminate that from human nature. But it is
true. That holds a lot of people back from doing it because of
yes,
that.
Yes, it does. It does. But you know what? People will continue to invent, people will continue to innovate, and the world will become a better place. It just takes a while.
And it'll happen. It will happen. I don't think it can be stopped or slowed down. Annie is in Birmingham, Alabama now. Welcome to the show. Annie, go ahead.
Hello. You mentioned a boy that invented a machine which takes carbon out of the air. Well, I hope they don't take carbon dioxide out of the air, because we depend on that to live, because carbon dioxide is inhaled by plants, which in turn give us the oxygen that we breathe. So we have to keep a healthy balance in the air of carbon dioxide and oxygen. We must not deplete any more carbon dioxide from the air than is necessary to make the plants flourish. Otherwise, we will all die.
Well, that's true, and they even had more carbon dioxide during the dinosaur eras. Go ahead, Charles.
You are absolutely correct. This is one of the things that struck me as amazing. There was a UN resolution that they were working on, and they said, we're going to set some carbon dioxide limits, and we're going to remove it from the atmosphere until we get down to a certain figure. If they were actually successful in doing that, it would be a threat to the plant life on Earth. So it just proves that the people who are making the rules have no idea how things work.
Charles, I had an opportunity to chat with Bob Zubrin this weekend doing one of our Beyond Belief television shows, and he was telling us about the plans to terraform Mars. And it's an amazing plan to develop and to try to get Mars to have its full atmosphere again. That's exciting.
Well, it's red.
Well, I think we're losing you on the phone a little bit.
Okay. I read a lot of his work back, and he had some amazing proposals. And I think that he's probably one of the best people to make these sorts of plans. His experience in chemistry and in space flight are immeasurable. It can be exciting. We're going to see these things on the horizon soon.
Let's go to Tom in California. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
Cerritos, how you doing?
Good.
Real quick, I think one of the reasons why we fear computers taking over is that our history is that we've never had a invention that we didn't use to subjugate people eventually, or many of the things we create. And there's that fear, I think, that somebody's going to take over computers to use them against us, or maybe even the computers themselves. It's just our nature to fear the worst, because we've done it to so many other people. But that's not my real comment. My comment was, people are talking about Einstein and coming out of nowhere and all that. And people, I think a lot of people don't realize that Einstein was working in a patent office. He's obscure, very obscure, and he comes up with this theory that finally that a couple gets papers published, and it revolutionizes everything. Because that, if he was in the same situation today, would he actually be able to get his theory out for the same reasons you just talked about? You know, the professional jealousy and all the monolithic everything is.
That's an exact problem right there. I think you hit the nail on the head. The society has closed itself, and by the society, I mean the society of colleges, the educational system. If you provide something that is new and innovative and different, there are so many hoops to jump through, and rightly so in many ways. You have to be able to supply information that can be tested and verified. When you come out with a new theory, and it upsets a lot of people, a lot of times it isn't even the decision not to look at it, but it's just a societal thing. Anybody who knows the story of Chandrasekhar, the fellow who did the astrophysics and figured out the formation of black holes, knows he ran head-to-head against the royal astronomer. And the royal astronomer stated that it was impossible. He invoked consensus, and he actually, through his efforts, Chandrasekhar gave up and left astrophysics, and his papers were brilliant. But people said, "Well, we're going to go with the chief astronomer. We know he's not right, but he's the boss." And so it was a sociological phenomenon that closed the doors on that work.
Liz is in Portland, Oregon now. Hi, Liz. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Sir Charles, I was just wondering what your thoughts are. Oh, excuse me, I'm nervous. Your thoughts are on the Hadron Collider in CERN, and what kind of new discoveries are they going to make in 2015 when they power it up to 100%? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Liz. Thanks. CERN, Hadron Collider.
Well, you know, if I could tell what they were going to discover, I would already be writing the paper now. However, that's a very fair question. And I think what they're really trying to do at this point is verify the hardware works well enough and not invoke the sort of damage they had last time. They're smashing these particles together to see what the underlying structure is, because the debris gives off very specific fingerprints or measurements that allow you to analyze the most basic structure of matter. So we are so close to having a complete picture, as far as we can tell, of how the universe works, how the underlying physics works. And that's what they're trying to discover, the rules underneath what we know.
This discovery, some people thought that they were going to create black holes out there at CERN. What did you think of that?
Well, it's quite possible. But the issue is this. Even if you could prevent, even if you could create a black hole by smashing particles together, the black hole that would be created by it would have such an incredibly short lifespan that it couldn't possibly be a threat. It would be smaller than a proton, so it couldn't swallow any matter, and it would decay almost instantaneously. But what it would do is create, again, a specific set of fingerprints that we could measure so we would know that it had ever been there.
Well, the future looks bright as far as I'm concerned, Charles. I hope you agree.
I do. I see that we're going to make this a better world. We can't allow darkness and evil to color our thinking. We have to stick with what we know. We have to solve problems as we see them. And we have to know we've earned the right to happy and peaceful lives.
Well, we do. And let's hope we'll do it in our lifetime, huh?
Absolutely. We're going to all do what we can to see it happen.
Charles, thanks again for being on the program, and keep in touch with us when the game hits the market. I'd like to get an update from you.
I'd be happy to, George, and thank you again for having me on the show. I always enjoy it.
Absolutely. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.